I could say, John, what's on the show this week?
Okay,
but it's not this week, is it? Because it's this month.
This time.
What's on this month? What's on the show this time? This time.
What's on this? What's on the show this episode? Oh, I don't know, something like that. Damn, we need to do scripts, man.
We do a little bit, but that's fine. Right, okay, ready.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of PR Hub Podcast. My name is Adam Tuckwell.
And I'm John Wilcox.
And John, what do we have lined up for this episode?
Well, we'll be talking about the news and events over the last sort of few weeks. We've got the PRCA census results. We'll have a quick chat about BrewDog and the question of who owns an idea. And of course, we've got the interview with Director General of the PRCA, Francis Ingham, coming on later on.
But before we start talking about that, John, you had an exciting adventure to Norwich recently. What was that for?
Do you know what? I really did. I like Norwich. Can I just start off by saying I really like Norwich, and I think it gets a bad rap. People take the mick, but it's a lovely city. So people should just go there because it's fab. But yeah, I was in Norwich along with 70 other delegates for the CIPR East Anglia Best Practice Conference, and it was a fantastic day. Happened last week as we're recording this, and it was really fascinating, really great to hear some of the ideas and some of the best practice that's put into place by companies up and down the region and beyond. It was really great. It was my first conference. I'm not a CIPR member. I'm not a PRCA member either, for the record. And I thought it was really, really fascinating. I think it just shows that going to conferences, just to sort of open yourself up to learning and developing your skills is a really important thing to do. And so an important message that Jenny Field, the incoming president elect of the CIPR, is really trying to get across as well for when she takes the post in January.
That's fascinating. I was really sad not to be able to make it this time. I've been to many of the other ones, and it's a fantastic conference. And what I really like about it is that it's able to bring together a really good collection of expert speakers and industry leaders to talk. But it's a unifier. It's a wonderful opportunity to get together as PR practitioners and professionals and share ideas and insights too. If you had one big takeaway from the event, John, what was it? What sort of grabbed you from the event?
Do you know, for me, it was just about the enthusiasm of the delegates. Everybody was there to learn. Everybody really was very enthusiastic about expanding their knowledge in a really good range of subjects that was being discussed, whether that was influencer marketing, straight through to crisis communications online, and even mental health, which is obviously something we discussed last time around with the CIPR survey, and we'll discuss the PRCA census results as well this time around.
There's more to PR than media relations, John.
There is. And I think but that's an important thing to remember. I think all too often, and this is something actually, oh God, I can't believe we're doing this for the second episode in the trot, but spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. You know, Francis and I have a bit of a chat about the importance of looking beyond media relations, the sort of sexy side of PR, in our interview. And, you know, things like reputation management is such a key part of PR now, whether you're in-house or agency. And of course, I'm not sure whether necessarily everybody is taking it seriously enough. So, yeah.
I think it's really important. I think we need to focus on internal comms in one of our next episodes, because there's a clear appetite there for things that we could share and learn. So a fantastic conference, and one you'd thoroughly recommend to other people. So we've picked a few stories from the last few weeks that have grabbed our attention. We try and mix it up a bit and try and find stories that you might not have seen. There are a few that are sort of headline breakers, but there are others that might have slipped between the radar. And John and I have a lot of fun trying to pull these together. The first one we wanted to cover for this episode is a story which probably you will have picked up on, or certainly if you've been reading any PR or marketing publications of late, which is this controversy around the Scottish brewing firm Brewdog, and the agency Manifest. And essentially, for those of you that haven't seen it, Brewdog have created a new light version or low alcohol version of one of their drinks, and they've launched it this week with a campaign called Punk, which obviously is something that they do quite a lot. Punk AF, and obviously AF has a wonderful double meaning of alcohol free, but also words that we probably can't say on the podcast. And when Alex Myers, who's the boss of Manifest, saw the release, he obviously got exceptionally concerned, because he feels that this creative, this idea, this naming is exceptionally close to an idea which he pitched when Manifest were retained by Brewdog, and ones which they discarded. And essentially, he's called Brewdog out publicly to say that his idea is being used without due credit or remuneration for Manifest. And it's something that in my time in the industry, I haven't seen somebody call out a big company like this. And I wonder whether it's being done in a public forum, and it goes on a lot behind the scenes in terms of lawyers speaking to lawyers. But I wanted to talk about it today to see if this is something that is rife within the sector, or it's something which is a one-off, and whether Alex has done the right thing or the wrong thing by calling Brewdog out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important thing. I think it's a really important thing that he called them out, to be honest with you. I feel that this wasn't a surprise. Not that, you know, it happened at all to the specific company and agency, but I kind of mean that the idea that a company would lean heavily on a pitch idea from an agency, that doesn't come as a surprise to me. I'm sure that any of our listeners, some of them may have experienced it themselves. I mean, if so, do let us know. Do get in touch on Twitter at PR Hub. Let us know your experience of that. Personally, I'm not surprised that this sort of practice goes on. I'm very intrigued to find out how many agencies, the percentage of agencies, are actually affected by this sort of thing. But I do think it's a very, very good thing the Manifest has called it out. It may have been innocent, but I do think that it's the right thing to for the sake of transparency that Manifest has done what they've done.
I think it's interesting. There was a news release today, the day that we're filming the pod, which says that the two of them have reached an amicable conclusion. So it'll be interesting to see if details of that come out. I think it poses an interesting question for professionals. Obviously, the idea of who owns a creative and how creatives are formed is one which I think the lines are pretty clear as to what happens. But looking back on my career and my time, I've sat through a large number of briefings. Many times I've done it in-house, as well as so being on the receiving end, as well as being presented to. And I remember in one of my first jobs, where we had a large number of agency pitches. We were building a global roster of agencies. And so we probably sat through maybe 30 pitches from different agencies around the world. And it's clear that actually in many cases, there isn't a huge amount of creativity, and many ideas are repeated. Many ideas are shared by multiple agencies. The obvious go-to ones are often covered off by some of them. Others show much more creativity and do things really clever. I think one of the biggest challenges that I found in that role is that many of the agencies were coming up with ideas which we'd already thought of. And so at the time, it made me question how we take ownership of an idea, even if it's during the pitch meeting, to try and demonstrate that actually, if we then go ahead and use that example, how do we as the client validate that we'd thought of it first? Obviously, in many cases, in those examples, these were ideas for a press release or a news story or a news angle, rather than a creative campaign. This is obviously on a much larger scale. But I guess it does pose the question as to how one creates or sort of rubber stamps creativity. I think there is a bigger undertone of a story here, in that Manifest are no longer retained by Brewdog. And so there is a question of ideas created during the time when they were retained, and possibly who owns that. But I think it's been interesting to see an agency call out a brand, especially one who is as controversial or news-friendly as Brewdog to suggest that this might be playing a slightly dirty game on this front.
Yeah, for sure. As I said, for me, I'd be very intrigued to find out of our listeners who's come across similar sort of things in the past. My suspicion that things have been resolved amicably between the two parties means that we're not going to hear anything more of it, shockingly. But yeah, I think they were right to call it out, and let's see whether that prompts other agencies to do, to do similar action in the future.
And massive respect to Manifest, because it's a very clever, creative idea.
I would love to step in and sort of lighten things by talking about a story that I saw today on PR Week, which is that Tenio, which is the fourth biggest PR consulting agency in the UK, it's got a turnover of about £45 million. The CEO, Gordon Tempest Hay, has threatened to close the consultancy's London Bridge office bar because of what he described as out-of-hand behaviour of staff. He compared them, he likened them to student nights out, because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's horrific. His email was leaked to the Times, which I think is a heck of a result in any case. I mean, that's an example right there, amazing mainstream coverage, but for all the wrong reasons. It's vile. It's absolutely vile. If you're eating your dinner,
stop
listening to this. Just pause the pod, come back to us in a bit. Okay, have you done that? Great. Okay. So basically, apparently it's only a small percentage of staff, but, and I quote, over the last few weeks, we have had, this is Tenio, over the last few weeks, we have had someone get drunk and throw up over the carpet. They've apologized, but still, someone, I can't put this any less bluntly, poo in the shower, and someone mess their underwear and leave it for the cleaner. Now, this is a company that William Hague, the former Tory leader and foreign secretary, is one of their sort of leaders. This is and not only that, as I said, this is fourth biggest agency in the country. This is not good. It's vile.
I think it's a fascinating story. I think it is terrible for the agency that this internal email has appeared in a national newspaper. I think if I was a client of the agency, I'd be extremely concerned. But also, I think it demonstrates something about perhaps the culture of some agencies, this focus on letting your hair down on a Friday afternoon. I think the agency bears part of the responsibility, having a bar, for example, although I know that, John, your workplace does have an on-site bar as well. But I think it's really interesting to see that actually maybe some of the ramifications or the reasons behind why people might be behaving this way are tied into some of the other stories that we cover. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the PRCA census, which covers the amount of time people work, the amount of pressure people are being put under. And then you mix that all up in a pressure pot with lots of young and vibrant and excitable people, and then fuel them with alcohol, and then they go and misbehave. Perhaps this is a misplaced piece of internal communications, or it is a wider problem at the agency where they're really struggling to manage, maintain and look after their workforce who are behaving, as it said in the email, like clubbing teenagers.
Fantastic. Clubbing teenagers. I mean, you're absolutely correct. I would say that Beer Friday is probably something that a lot of agencies partake in. I don't know whether this happened on a Friday, but, alcohol can be at the heart of agency life. It can be a part of in-house life. I think that there's a reason why people have the perception that PR people are out boozing and schmoozing with would-be clients, that they're out celebrating, the champagne is flowing, and all that sort of stuff. But I think this is something else, and I think that there has to be a level of responsibility on the part of the company. But I think the HR team, they're probably working overtime at the moment, which probably also isn't helping the amount of alcohol being consumed.
Maybe their lawyers should have written the internal communication rather than the boss.
Maybe, yeah.
But a fantastic story, and it'll be very keen to keep a watchful eye on Twitter to see what people start to say and comment about that story, because it's a very interesting one for us mere observers.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam, what's your second story?
So the final thing that I wanted to talk about was the PRCA census. So this is our third podcast episode, and we've been blessed with two censuses, not one, but two censuses from the two leading PR organisations in the UK. So we've already had the CIPR version. We're now followed closely on its heels with the PRCA annual census, and we're very excited to have the Director General of the PRCA on our pod later on in this episode. But John, we've got the results of their census, and whilst there's quite a number of similarities with the CIPR one in relation to the amount of work people are doing, the amount of pressure people are under, the salaries that people get, there are a few things that really jump out of this report. We've had an opportunity to digest it, but a couple of the things that really jumped out to me or surprised me slightly is things around accessibility in the workplace. So people being able to have flexible working, people to be able to work from home, has been some slightly surprising statistics for me. So 41% of comm staff who work, this is in-house specifically, have the ability to work from home and to have flexible start and finish time, so to work around their time. And 31% of people work from home at least once a week. And while that's down a tiny bit on last year's census, I was really impressed by that, because one of the main criticisms that we have of our sector is the always on culture and the fixed requirements of people having to be in a office or the office for particular times. And so actually I was quite encouraged by that, at a time when both our organisations are championing health awareness and mental health awareness in the workplace. I found that quite refreshing that people are being given the independence to work from home, to work remotely, and to try and fit work around their lives. I thought that was quite encouraging.
On the subject of mental health, what I found very interesting was that in the census at the PRCA, 32% of respondents admitted that they suffered from or have been diagnosed with mental ill health. And I think, again, it's such an important topic that we need to be talking about. Obviously, it affects other sectors as well. But I attended the mental health discussion at the CIPR Best Practice Conference last week, and it is clear that people in agency, people in-house, are under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure, and mental health disorders such as depression and anxiety, they are far from being uncommon in the agency, in the industry. And I think seeing a third admit in the survey, if anything, I think that's low. And I think some of that will be down to the fact that respondents perhaps feel uneasy about admitting that they suffer from mental ill health.
I strongly encourage everybody to download a copy of the PRCA report and to take some time investigating it. I think there are some really interesting nuggets buried within it, not just about welfare and mental health, but also about the tasks and roles of individual practitioners, the type of things that we think we need to be upskilling over time. There's an interesting piece on evaluation, and we know that the PRCA and the CIPR have done a great deal of work to try and encourage people to move away from those dreaded AVEs. And it's pleasing to see that only 7% practitioners are now using AVEs, which is down 5% from last year. So things are moving in a very positive direction. Although rather worryingly, 26% do not use any PR evaluation mechanism, which is really surprising as a statistic for me.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to raise with Francis. We obviously talk about evaluation in the interview. And I was quite shocked that 26% don't use PR evaluation methods. And therefore, you've got to ask the question, what are they reporting to their bosses? What are they reporting to C-suite? We need to be, as an industry, able to sit at that table, or at least have the ears of those sat at that table. And I don't think you can do that if you're not using evaluation methods. The Barcelona principles are absolutely vital. They're incredibly important for us as an industry. And over one in four of us aren't using them. It's great to see AVEs dropped to 7%. That is long overdue. And the other thing I have to point out, 16% use impressions as a means for evaluation. My issue of that is that doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you, do you know what I mean? It doesn't tell you about the sentiment of the coverage. It doesn't tell you about the quality of the coverage. When you're saying 60, you know, you've got a registered an impression on a website, is that a single mention in a 1,000 word piece that discusses your competitors? Or is it solely focused on your latest product? Who knows?
And is it, it's not even the impression of the piece of coverage that you secured, is the impression of the site as a whole. So a wonderful idea that if you get an article on Whisper It, the Daily Mail, you're able to reach the biggest news audience, you know, in the world, or whatever the ridiculous stat is about people that read the Daily Mail. Apologies if you're a Daily Mail reader. You know, you're simply got a piece of coverage that appears on a news item within that website, which has a huge volume of news created every day. So it's an interesting one, and I'm glad you pointed out that statistic as well. It surprised me somewhat when I read it to you.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that jumped out at me as well was the eternal question when it comes to PR: is PR a profession or an industry? Now, I know the PRCA are holding a debate on that this month. What I found really interesting in the survey, was that 50% believe that PR is a profession, which is a 6% decrease on last year, and 42% believe that PR is an industry, which is up 7% on the previous year. My question is this: what do the remaining 8% think they're working in?
It's
do you know what I mean? Answers on a postcard.
It's a fair point. I love the fact that it's split. It's quite close to being a Brexit majority, isn't it?
I was thinking that.
And what's strange, I'm obviously very actively involved in our, I'm trying not to use the word professional or industry here, in our sector and the work that we do. And I genuinely could not care less about whether we were working in an industry or if it was a profession. I certainly do my work in a professional way, and I see myself as working within a PR industry. And I think attending a conference or a debate to decide which we should be, I could certainly think of better things to do with my evening than that.
That's a very good point. It's a very good point. The other thing that really jumped out at me was that when it came to a breakdown of tasks that people working in communications do, this is quoted directly from the census. The tasks that have increased in importance are digital, so 52% believed that was vitally important. Online communication, 28%. SEO, 21%. 19% reputation management. Less than one in five of respondents believed that reputation management was the most important thing that they should be working on. Reputation management has to be one of the key tenets of the PR industry. If you're not doing reputation management for your agency or your agency's clients, or if you're in-house, the company that you work for, it's vital. You have to be doing it. This is seriously important. I think it's going to become increasingly more important as time goes on. I certainly think that if people don't have a crisis comms plan and escalation processes in place, do it tomorrow. Make sure that, you know, if you have to clear email, first go and clear email. But you've got to start getting reputation management systems in place.
Very, very important. One of the things that jumps out of this report, but all reports really, is that everybody seems to identify that digital is the one big thing that we need to be focusing on or learning. And that sort of sits slightly uncomfortable with me as a statistic when we see how young our industry is. So actually, I'm constantly reminded with the young people that I work with in my agency, and I'm 34, is that the vast majority of these people working in our sector, especially in these junior positions, are people that have grown up with the internet. They're digital natives. And actually, the idea that we should be seeing digital as a threat or something that we need to upskill on highlights more about what we need to do as older professionals, and that's older at 34, than professionals as a whole, because it seems ridiculous that we keep talking about digital. Actually, what we need to think is more generally how we incorporate all tactics and techniques into the work that we deliver to generate results. And we mustn't put digital on a pedestal. It's just a channel that we should be utilizing and utilizing to the full. As we draw a close to the PRCA census, why not introduce ourselves, John, to the interview that you recently conducted with Francis, the Director General of the PRCA?
Yeah, so I spoke to Francis last week. It was the week after the census was released. I spoke to him over the phone. He was in PRCA Towers in London. I mean, the guy is super busy, so I was absolutely thrilled when he said he was able to make time to speak to us last week. Yeah, Francis is Director General of the PRCA. He's also Chief Executive of the IOOCO, which is the International Communications Consultancy Organization. He's also one of the executives at LG Communications, which is all about communications for local government comms professionals. He's got a background largely in public affairs as well as communications. His first role, actually, out of Oxford University, was working as policy advisor for the Conservative Party during the somewhat tempestuous times of William Hague's leadership of the party. So back in the day when then New Labour had a massive majority, so we discussed that as well. Overall, Francis was brilliant to talk to. Very much appreciated him coming on the pod. Super busy guy. And we spoke to him on the phone last week. Today on the pod, I'm speaking with Francis Ingham, who is Director General of the PRCA and has been since November 2007. Hi, Francis. Thanks very much for doing the interview today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, as well as being DG of the PRCA, you're also a CEO of the International Communications Consulting Organization, the IOOCO. You've been there for 6.5 years, and you're also Executive Director of Local Government Communications as well. You're super busy.
I'm reasonably busy. I mean, why it is I've ended up with three jobs, it is that there are certain common challenges that PR practitioners are all over the world in every sector of practice face. So they are as relevant for PRCA in the UK and in Singapore and in Dubai as they are for ECO in 66 countries and for local government practitioners in 150 local authorities throughout the UK, and they're around, you know, creating value, attracting talent, growing the industry, and showing the value that we deliver all in an ethical and professional framework. So, three different roles, all slightly different, but all with those common features.
Absolutely. Well, before we sort of delve into some of those details, I'd like to sort of take you back 21 years or so. You graduated from Oxford University. You read philosophy, politics, and economics. It's a course that is, well, world-renowned, to be frank, and enjoys an alumni that pretty much reads like a who's who of British politics and journalism. David Cameron, Yvette Cooper, both Miliband brothers, William Hague, Tony Benn, Michael Crick, Nick Cohen, Robert Peston. I mean, the list does go on and on. What was your time like at Oxford, and what did you have your sights set on
during your time as a student? Was it a career in politics or in journalism?
Well, I left home at 15, and I lived in a hostel in Manchester. And my school very kindly took me back without paying school fees. And from that hostel, it was a pretty rough place. I got into Oxford to read PPE, which was my dream course. In fact, I mean, my experience at Oxford was very much two contrasting bits, actually. On the one hand, I hated my college. It was a very, very left-wing college, and I didn't fit in there at all well. On the other hand, I spent an awful lot of time at the Oxford Union, including being the press officer for the union, where I met a great deal of significant people, including a King of Jordan and a lot of politicians and media people as well. And I suppose that was my first taste of PR. My ambition had always been to be political, but that didn't quite work out. And actually, it didn't quite work out for the best. I'm very, very happy with how my career has developed without that political element.
I mean, you say that it developed without a political element, but your first job after Oxford was as a policy advisor for the Conservative Party during William Hague's leadership?
It was during Hague's leadership. So we were, I was about to say we were as unpopular as a party as we had been. I suppose that speaking at the current time, that would be untrue, given the party's opinion poll ratings. But I left Oxford at a particular low point for the Conservative Party, 1998, just after the destruction of the 97 election. So not the best time to leave university if somebody who wants to pursue a career in public affairs or politics, really.
I mean, yeah, I was going to ask, would you describe your time as policy advisor a bit of a baptism of fire for you?
It was a great learning experience. When you're representing a brand that is extremely unpopular and that has reached rock bottom, the only way is up. And naturally, that was something that I found very useful when I moved to the PRCA 11 years ago or 12 years ago, because we were in a pretty bottom place ourselves at that point in time.
Okay. I mean, yeah, you've been at the PRCA now for 12 years, as you said. The PRCA is now, this year, celebrating its 50th anniversary. In that time, how has the industry developed and matured? How has the PRCA developed and matured? And have they both grown for the better?
Sure. Well, my standing joke has always been that I nearly asked my old job back at the CIPR in my second week as director of the PRCA. Because we had our national awards. Our high point of the year in the afternoon in a sticky nightclub in Camden called Coco's with a deadlift comedian where it was so bad that people left unopened bottles of champagne that were their own on the tables.
Oh.
So that was a low point. And these days, as you mentioned, PRCA runs two other membership bodies, one of them international. As I mentioned, we have opened up to members around the world and have physical offices in Singapore and Dubai. We're easily the largest PR association in the world, and we would be just on our UK members alone. And I think over those years, we've done some great things, like running the PR apprenticeship program on behalf of the government, so welcoming people into the industry who wouldn't otherwise have even considered it. And, for example, beating the NRA at the European Court in Luxembourg, changing copyright law for all our members, indeed all practitioners, and actually all people in 28 countries in Europe. So it's a record I look back on with some pride.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fair to say that all those 12 years the PRCA has been turned around, 180, it's you know, of the highest standing, I think, in the industry these days. You talk about low points. I mean, perhaps when it comes to difficult times for the organisation and your leadership of it, perhaps came in 2017 when the PRCA took the decision to kick Bell Pottinger out of the Oak Bay scandal. As we all know, Bell Pottinger didn't last very long afterwards because of the destruction of his reputation. Looking back, how important was it that the PRCA took such decisive action, and was it a simple decision to make?
It wasn't simple because we were very aware of the size and the global reputation of Bell Potts, in many ways the most famous PR company in the world, actually. And we were also aware of the international dimension and element to it. And, you know, if you look at, if you just Google PRCA and Bell Prosecutor, you come up with 113,000 hits. And we didn't think it would be quite that big, but we knew it would be significant.
Mm.
We were always very clear we were going to do the right thing. That was my stock phrase throughout it, regardless of pressure from any person or institution who might want to exert pressure upon us, because we realised it's a very significant moment for the industry. Now, we took the decision we took based purely on the evidence that was provided. I mean, no doubt at all, it was the right decision. But we would have taken the opposite decision had the evidence been in the opposite balance. Looking back, I am very clear that had we not taken the decision to expel Bell Potts, it would have been a terrible moment for the PR industry. It would have proved that there were no standards and you could get away with it, whatever you wanted to. Because we took the hard decision that we took, that we showed the industry had a code, that it enforced that code, and that breaking that code has very significant consequences. And I was personally very happy with the reaction of the wider industry in supporting us when we took that decision, because the fact the industry said, yes, you've done the right thing, came out vocally in doing so, proved the industry as a whole had standards and wanted to be held to those standards.
Bell Potts' reputation, as I said, took an absolute nosedive. And reputation management in the comms industry is at the very sort of heart of I think where it needs to be. You know, right? If you don't have a good reputation in yourself, how on earth can you sort of uphold the reputation of your clients, for instance?
Entirely. And my view is always, has always been since, that probably 10 years ago, Bell Potts could have survived. It could have survived because public expectations were different. One might say lower. Because public scrutiny was much less, because the social media element wasn't there, and because companies were valued on things other than their reputation. And it is clear to me that one of the main drivers for the growth of the PR industry over the last 10 years that I've seen has been companies investing more and more in the knowledge of their reputation, the most valuable thing that they have. And that plays very well for our industry, but obviously it also means that practitioners within our industry have to be very mindful indeed of their own reputation, and that's what Bell Potts proved.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually leads very nicely onto my next question, really, is do you think agencies and in-house teams overlook reputation management in favour of general comms strategies or sort of more sexier media relations side of comms? And sorry, go on.
No, it's going to be two things there, really. PR agencies and the PR industry as a whole have always been poor at their own reputation, but that could be said of any practice, frankly, any profession, professional services body or sector in the country. The thing that we see driving the growth of the industry, and we have data on this as well as just anecdotal commentary, it's CEO's investment in corporate reputation, it's marketing spend moving from advertising to PR, it's PR practitioners diversifying the services that they offer, and it's the rise of digital. And, you know, in every piece of research I've seen by PR and Eco over the last decade, the importance of digital and spend on digital rises every single year, and it's driving our industry forward. We had an Eco Global Summit in Oxford, I think, 3 years ago, where Peter Chadlington said that if you're not master of digital, you're going to be dead. I think he used the image of the hamster wheel, the wheel. those factors are driving the industry forward, and the industry I see grows every year in every region of the world, and it's a brilliant one to be in, albeit not without challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, talking about challenges, I think one of the big reputation management stories of the year to date sits with Boeing and its 737 MAX aircraft. You know, as we all know, they've been grounded around the world following the two fatal air disasters. Boeing's reputation appears to be incredibly tarnished and almost further damaged on a weekly basis at the moment, not only because of the hardware and software faults that people are finding, but also the way that the company has handled its crisis communications. What's your take on how they've managed it?
Well, I wouldn't give a commentary on Boeing, so I think they're one of our members, actually. And we try not to give commentary on any specific case or of our members. But I mean, I think there's a commonality of responses to crisis that prove certain things you ought to do is to respond fully and fast and in an honest and committed way, and then try and move on. And my experience over the last 12 years at PRCA is that normally it's the PR people in the room, in boardroom, who are giving that advice of, let's be honest, that they've made a mistake, and try and move on from this, make redress, and do it the right way. And too often it's the legal advice in the room who are giving the, you know, let's not make committal comments on this, and legally speaking, we've done nothing wrong. And I've always thought it's the role of our fellow practitioners to make the moral case, but and also the self-interested case. Tell the truth, get it out there, sort it out, and move on. It's both the right thing to do, ethically, it's also in your best interest. I'm sure that all the examples we could all think of over the last decade where companies have screwed it up prove the value of those views.
Absolutely, and again, it just comes back to the importance of practitioners, you know, putting reputation management at the core of everything that they do.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, we keep on harking back to an organisation that's most valuable asset is its reputation, and that is as true of a massive company operating all around the world as it is of a small boutique PR agency or a tiny charity operating somewhere in the UK.
We're recording this interview about a week or so after the PRCA launched the PR and Communication Census 2019 results. I went through the report with great interest, actually. It was a really fascinating read. A couple of things that I'd like to sort of ask you, though. The industry value, according to the study, has grown by 7.9% year on year in the UK. Yet salaries are down across the board. What do you think is behind this contrasting fortune?
So what we have is we have an industry that grows year on year, and the numbers that we produced, and they are constructed by a survey of the industry, but also by our research company triangulating those responses with ONS data, so the numbers are robust. What we've seen is industry growth roughly 10% a year in terms of value. And that happened over the last 12 months, and it grew slightly more than 10% in terms of number of practitioners. And that's all good news, and it's an industry that gets bigger and bigger every year. So we're now approaching £15 billion of value and 100,000 practitioners. The salary issue is obviously very disappointing for the industry, and it's in fact reflective of what's happened over the last 6 or 7 years. My take on it is that we're just having more and more junior levels of staff brought into the industry. So there is probably the same number or a greater number of highly paid people within the industry, but there's a greater number of lower paid people coming in at the bottom end and lowering average salaries. And we can see that from the fact that, in fact, the number of people already within the industry who had a pay rise last year was significantly higher than the year before, and it was a decent pay rise as well. So we're just having more junior people entering the industry. Now, I think there are some problems with that. We're going to become, well, I can't say top-heavy, but bottom-heavy, and we need to address that if we're going to make the case for our industry being increasingly strategic and high-value advice end of the scale.
absolutely. You're talking about getting PR into a place. I guess a seat at the sort of C-suite or board level, really, to make those or help inform those strategic decisions at that level. How can the PRCA, or what is the PRCA doing to help guide people through their sort of career path and journey to becoming those sort of senior members?
Yeah, I mean, we provide support at every level. So, you know, before people are in the industry, we do a school outreach program to get people to join direct from school if they're not going to have a degree, using the apprenticeship program or a direct route. We partner with 20-odd universities to influence the content of their degrees and to give their students a better understanding of the industry. And then everything in terms of training, professional development, networks, and support all the way throughout anyone's career. So the highest end of our membership would be our PRCA fellows, for example, who next week are debating the perennial topic of is PR an industry or a profession. The bigger point of view, though, the bigger issue is about making the case for PR as being, yes, tactical, and it always will be, and there will always be a place for media relations, but also strategic and able to advise chief executive chairman about the big issues that face the industry, and able to prove its value. And proving its value is, I genuinely think, at the heart of pretty much every challenge that we face as a profession or as an industry. And it's an area where we've done a great deal of work over the years and will continue to do so going forward.
Great. I mean, actually, on that topic, I was very pleased to see that AVEs continue to be dying off. The survey revealed that 7% of respondents use them now to evaluate their campaigns, which is a figure low enough that it's more than overdue to see that figure drop like that. However, more than a quarter said they don't use any evaluation metrics, and 16% use impressions.
So, the good thing on evaluation is that if you compared it to a decade ago, it's unimaginably different. AVEs, when I began PRCA, were the almost default setting of the industry, now down to 7%. You say they are their preferred method, and that's down by 5% from last year. So we have been very happy to say that AVEs in the UK are dead. Now, that's not the case in different parts of the world, including parts of the world where RECOM and PRCA operate, very different market. But in every part of the world, usage goes down every year. It's all going in the right direction. And equally, the number of people who say they don't use any evaluation whatsoever is now 26%, so a quarter. But that's down from 33%, as in a third, last year. So again, extrapolating out, those numbers will decline again and will be at a point soon, I hope, where we can say that everyone uses some evaluation methods. And then we'll look at impressions too high, and we'll say we need to cut down that number as well. Essentially, the industry becomes more sophisticated every year in the UK and everywhere around the world. We need to keep hammering this home. And that's why we've worked for these last 12 years with AMEC very closely. It's chief executive for the last 11 years. It is now PRCA international president, working closely with me on our international footprint and activity. And his placement, Jonah Berg, the new chief executive of AMEC, he is somebody with whom I already have a great working relationship. I'll be the AMEC Global Summit in Prague next week, where we'll continue our common work to make evaluation more sophisticated. So, as in many areas, a great deal to celebrate, much more to be done, but let's not ignore the direction of travel is the positive one.
Bit of a question, bit of an apt question, given the fact that we're recording this during Mental Health Awareness Week. Nearly a quarter of respondents said they suffered from or have been diagnosed with mental illness. given the CIPD released the results of their study on the topic in the wider workplace and wider industries, that revealed 37% of sufferers are more likely to get into conflict with colleagues and 50% are potentially less patient with customers and clients. How can the PRCA support its member organisations and sort of help them manage this epidemic of mental ill health?
Yeah, so I mean, there were a few things you said about that, really. It started a high number. 32%, I think, of respondents said they have suffered mental ill health at some point of their career, and that's far too high, and it's higher than for the average member of the workforce in the UK for work to be done. Secondly, and it does have an impact on the bottom line and on everything that employers care about in the whole moment, as well as in just a solid way. But I'd also say the thing, and we're providing a lot of resources, so we're providing mental health toolkit, we're helping members as source for mental first aiders at work. The big thing we're doing now, the biggest change in the industry over the years, it is simply that people are happier to talk about this as an issue and to address it. Employers no longer consider it a taboo subject in the way they did previously, and employees are happier to talk about it. I mean, do we have further to go? Absolutely we do, but the employers that I speak with really want to address this. They see it as a big part of the challenges that face their companies, their organisation, and they want to get on top of it. Now, talent is the number one issue facing the industry, and that's at every level of the industry, in every part of the world. And so there is this competition for talent. So I think employers, apart from just doing the right thing, also want to appeal to the very best people. And being seen as modern and forward-looking, and being modern and forward-looking in this area, is really important. So, you know, I guess, again, one of those issues, let's not diminish the challenges we face, but let's also accept the progress is definitely being made. Can we do more? Yes, and we will do. But it is, again, a challenge that the industry is meeting in my view.
And this is going to be the question you probably get asked most frequently. And what in your opinion is the future of the comms industry? How important is big data and the integration of AI into our everyday working lives? And what's next for yourself and the PRCA?
Well, on the AI front, I take the kind of broad sweep of history view in that every new technology that's come in has been seen with trepidation, understandably, by the people who are in situ. But for every job it's destroyed, it's created more. So I'm positive about AI, I'm not negative about it. In terms of big data, well, I think it just helps us tell our story better and tell the story of our clients and colleagues better. And after all, the industry is brilliant at storytelling, so it's all to play to our strengths. The big picture that I see around the world from 12 years here is that, albeit with challenges, ours is a dynamic, vibrant, growing industry. The shift of spend from other disciplines towards us is going to continue. I just want us to attract even better people and retain people in our industry, become better at the gender pay gap, at social diversity, at ethnic diversity, at welcoming disabled people into the industry and being genuinely blind in terms of our recruitment and retention practices, proving our value and being even greater in the future than we are today, because the industry I see at the moment is already a great one.
And that brings the third episode of the PR Hub podcast to a close. Thank you so much for listening. It's really great to hear your feedback. So please do rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. And if you want to get in touch, and you can find us on Twitter, the PR Hub account is at PR Hub. I'm Adam Tuckwell, and I'm at Adam Tuckwell on Twitter. And John?
And I'm John Wilcox. I'm at John Wilcox _, no H in John. Francis Ingham, our thanks once again. He can be found at Ingers 1975. Music is Work by Kevin MacLeod. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.